welcome to another episode of Bitches on Comics, where we talk about comics, sometimes other things. My name, of course, is Sarah Century. I'm so happy that everybody is here listening to this podcast. And as usual, I have a special guest with me, and I would like for you to introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Jamie Lee Rotante, and I am the Senior Director of Editorial at Archie Comics. So I'm the one that's pretty much in charge of all of the those crazy Archie horror one-shots you see coming out now. I've also written quite a bit for the company. And aside from that, I have a bi-monthly article series on Razor Cake where I talk about mental health.
That was so efficient compared to me trying to tell what my resume is. I've been doing a lot of podcasts lately and people will be like, hey, and where can we find you? And I'm just like, well, I wrote a book and then I did this and then I did this and then I did this. And then it's just like, I talk about what I did that day. I bring my rabbits into the mix. Like, just turns into a very long rambling monologue. Very efficient.
I mean, if I had any rabbits, I'm sure I would have brought them into the mix too. That's just, you know.
Yeah, no, that's how it is though. Because somebody will be like, oh, how's your rabbits? And I'm just like, check my watch. And I'm like, okay, all right. Well, I guess we're going to get into this. Hopefully everybody's ready to talk for the next 3.5 hours while I talk about these creatures who have perhaps three brain cells amongst them all in a way that is like the absolute cutest thing in the world. And they are made of pure love and, you know, all of that. But they definitely are just like, one of them gets scared and then they're all scared, right? And it's just like, what was any one of you scared about? Nothing. Nothing happened, you know? And they all like are running around each other in a circle and you're just like, okay. Anyway, I digress again about my rabbits. People who listen to this show know that I will just take absolutely any segue and be like, they're cute. They're super cute. But let's talk to our guest about guest things. So you listed this so like sufficiently that it's just like, oh, but that's actually a ton of stuff. Like the Archie thing alone is like, okay, well, that must be the only thing you do with your time, because that is, you know, it's a line that I believe started what, probably around like 2015 or so. Is that correct?
So that, yes, the rebooted line started in 2015. I was still like an editorial assistant at that time. So the really coming into where what I've been doing and overseeing it started in 2021.
You know, I think that the horror line is going to be something that I keep returning to through this whole call. But before we get to that, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about, you've written a lot of Betty and Veronica stories, and I have so many things to say about Betty and Veronica. So, you know, I think I'm just going to start it out because I don't even think I have everything on this list. You wrote the Vixen series, and then I believe there's a sequel to that as well, right?
Yes, Vixens ran for, we have 2 volumes worth of that. So it was a miniseries, but we got 2 volumes out of it.
And how would you describe Vixens?
So the way I always kind of pitched it was, think of a Russ Meyer film, definitely more focused on female empowerment without as much of the cheesecakiness.
Yeah.
It was Betty and Veronica heading up an all-female biker gang in Riverdale.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of DC's Bombshell series, which was like a 40s pastiche kind of, but they just used it to just go off the rails and have a delightful time, from what I can tell. I felt in that sense, like that spirit of the project, then that kind of translated to me to Vixens, where it was like, this is sort of alternate timeline-ish, you know, but like not 100%. And then, because it's very much these characters as we know them. And it is a lot like a Russ Meyer's film. Like, it's very Faster Pussycat kind of. But as you say, a little bit toned down. Like, it's not like, what would it be if it's a Russ Meyer's movie? It's just like constant cleavage shots or something.
Yeah.
Like, but, which like, hey, you know what? God bless, right? But
oh, yeah.
But I think that, you know, you found a better, like perhaps a more fitting tone for the Betty and Veronica series. But yeah, I'd like to just talk a little bit about that because it was such a fun series. I'm trying to think if I read, it's like either I read the first or second volume or both, and I'm not 100% which one. But I do remember thinking that it was really fun because, you know, that's something that we really, to my knowledge, because there's so many Archie stories, right? So it's like whenever I'm like, oh, that never happened in an Archie comic, somebody's like, oh, contraire, yes, it did. And it's like this comic in 1965 had them like doing this. And you're just like, what? When did that happen? So I wanted to talk a little bit. Well, I guess, first of all, just like the Archie multiverse, because that's totally a thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And especially after Riverdale, like I remember watching like the 100th episode and being like, they win. They won the multiverse. This is my favorite multiverse. But yeah, where do you think that Vixens kind of fits in that timeline? And then also, yeah, what lends itself so well with Betty and Veronica to being in a motorcycle girl gang?
Yeah, so one of the things we always say at Archie is, in Archie, nothing is canon and everything's canon. That's pretty much every single thing in some way exists in a distinct timeline, just sort of separate. Even these one-shots are all in their own individual timelines, which is how
right.
certain characters can just keep getting killed and then coming back.
Yes.
There's no explanation. Because I sometimes, you know, we always say, especially with like writing short digest stories, if something absurd is happening, you don't have time to explain it. It's just happening
yeah.
because it's Riverdale and it can happen there. So we don't get too hung up on the timelines too much. But having so many concurrent ones also means that you could have fun with that if they start to blend at any point. Like, it gives a lot to work with. So Vixens was very distinct in that way. It was running parallel. It was still fairly early on when we started the rebooted series. So it was kind of parallel to that, but definitely not in that same continuity. In terms of just setting, I very purposefully kept it vague. I really didn't want it to feel too much of any era. I brought a lot of like 50s and 60s into it. There's a lot of like kind of rockabilly fashion as part of
yeah.
it. But one of the notes I also gave was like, Veronica could maybe be dressed like Audrey Horn in Twin Peaks. I wanted it to be very just like, doesn't matter when you're reading this. You don't know exactly where it's taking place. It's very of any time.
Oh, and that's like the Twin Peaks thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, so it's yeah. like, it's almost like, oh, well, that's like a built-in or like almost a foregone conclusion, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was probably doing a rewatch of the show at that time. So I had a little bit of that like David Lynch mindset there, you know, and that and John Waters and Russ Meyer all kind of taking place in my head at once when I was writing it.
That is three of my faves. So no wonder.
Oh, wonderful. Same here.
I had such a delightful time reading it. But I was also kind of curious, yeah, how do you think it kind of fits in the trajectory of the greater Betty and Veronica story? And we'll talk about this a little bit more because you've written other Betty and Veronica stories. So, but where do you think this one specifically is kind of a part of the ongoing story of their friendship?
So that's an interesting question. It takes place still during high school. It's definitely its own very distinct. It's so funny because I feel like I want to say it's in the future just because it's so progressive in terms of what it says about their friendship, because they're not fighting over Archie in this. They are
right.
very distinctly not. And I wanted to take them out of that. Like, I didn't want the values from like the 50s and 60s to be a part of it. So they are very distinct individuals, no longer fighting over Archie, having, you know, their own separate ways. So it's this very sort of like the vision of the future I wanted to see for Betty and Veronica and the evolution of their friendship.
Yeah. Isn't it kind of funny though? Because it's, I remember when Cheryl Blossom first shows up in, I believe like the 90s, that's a character who I always think is way older than what she actually is. But so she appears in like the early 90s, I think.
I believe it was mid to late 80s, actually.
Is that right? Okay, cool.
But she was banned, like, not officially banned, but she went away for a little bit. And
they
then
were like, get her out of here.
Yeah.
It was she's too chaotic. It was like a Catwoman in like the 60s where they were like, she's too sexy. Get her out of here.
Absolutely.
She can't appear here anymore. They've got the comics code now. but I think that there's something really to be said about it because it's like she shows up to be fighting with Betty and Veronica over Archie. And of course, this speaks to what we know of Cheryl as a queer person now. But whenever she first appears, she's just like, I just love how riled up Betty and Veronica get over it, you know? And you're like, people are like, why are you interested in Archie? And she's like, I'm not. And like, I'm dating him. I don't think he's interesting. But, you know, you speak for us all in some ways, Cheryl, because it's like, Archie is a lovable, wonderful character, but you always read these comics being like, why are you two fighting? Like, I don't quite know what to do with this because it does seem slightly anti-woman, obviously, often. But then there's times where you're just like, I think this is just part of what you all do to hang out. You know, like, I might be like, oh, I'm going over to the park. Does somebody want to come with me or something? Whereas Betty and Veronica are like, oh, I really want to talk to Betty, you know, or Veronica. And the way I'm going to do that is like pranking her about her boyfriend, who I'm also seeing or something. So it's like there's times where it's fun. And then there's times where you're like, okay, they're going to do something else now. Right. And I like that Vixens is that, like, it's just kind of like, cool, like, let's show what they do outside of that dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. And that was definitely something that I always really wanted to like hammer home, where it's just like they've, you know, we've, even when we sort of matured these characters, even when we had them in new settings, that element of the love triangle was always there in some way. And it didn't necessarily mean they were at each other's throats. We were even more, you know, thoughtful in our way of handling that. But I always thought, like, what if we have the guys involved and that isn't a factor at all? What if we're past that? What if, like, we don't have that to rely on? And with Vixens throughout, that was a big motivator, but I also didn't even want them to rely on the male characters for really anything. It was, you know, they're not the muscle. They're not the brains. Like, it's all about Betty, Veronica, and the ladies that they, you know, kind of get in their gang, including Cheryl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember when Cheryl pops up. It's super fun. This is like my favorite character. I've been obsessed with Cheryl for like a million years. Like,
Cheryl is probably my favorite Archie character of all time. I remember being younger, and it's so funny what you said before, because like that is such a perfect encapsulation of the character of just like, I'm not even necessarily here to date Archie. I just like causing chaos. And like, I remember like reading my Betty and Veronica comics, and I always loved them. And I loved, you know, even the stories that were a little bit softer, even the ones that were just them, you know, going shopping, having fun. But when they started reintroducing Cheryl and like really bringing her in, it was so chaotic. I remember just being like, I love this. This just feels so different. Like, this is so fun and exciting because she just always seems so unpredictable.
This is like, what I love. Yeah. She's the wild card.
She's the wild card
of the Archie universe. And it's like, I don't know that it's like they had all of these, they've had great stories with Cheryl since the beginning of Cheryl, but there's really something to be said about how Riverdale just like brought her to life in this way that's just like, well, that's Cheryl forever now, because none of us are going to buy any other take on Cheryl. Like,
and what's
just
great
this
too
kind
is,
of chaotic character.
Yeah. And it's really an extension of a lot of the elements of her character, even from, you know, her earliest appearance, because it's, if there's any character that's going to be that extreme, it's Cheryl.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just like, again, like they just, the writers don't seem that concerned with making her make sense, which is what I really appreciate. Like, she's just like, you know what? That was the vibe yesterday. Today, the vibe is this. So it's just like, you always know that when you see her, she's going to be doing something not expected, I guess. And that's what makes that character the greatest. But yeah, I've always loved these characters. And so I was going to ask, because also you wrote, you know, senior year, and I believe you also wrote a YA novel about Betty and Veronica. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Yes. Okay. So like, I was thinking about, you know, they are such interesting characters, but what is it that's drawn you to them again and again? Because I feel like, you know, that's been kind of like, I'm not going to say like the bulk, but it is a lot of the stuff that you've done for Archie has been Betty and Veronica, right? So
right.
I'd just love to hear more about like, what is it that compels you about them?
I think for me, it's just the fact that they are so incredibly different from one another. And that's the element that really drives their friendship. Even, you know, you kind of mentioned before how when they were fighting over Archie, sometimes that felt like that was not necessarily something that would throw a wrench in their friendship, but seemed to be the thing that kind of brought them together sometimes.
Yeah.
Because it was this weird shared interest that really didn't make sense for either of them.
Yeah, they wanted to fight, but then it was like, I just like you so much, right? Like there's something to that.
Yeah, and I love just like, it's always been there and it's always been more of this like, oh, it's crazy how these two people can be friends from such different backgrounds, different ways. And I always wanted to explore more of like, well, instead of that being the like, isn't it weird that they're friends because they have those differences? What if that's why they're friends? Because they kind of make up for in each other what maybe they lack themselves or what they aspire to be, they see in the other person. And that's always been the driving force of how I write them for, especially for Vixen's senior year, that comes up a lot in the YA graphic novel as well. But that's kind of my mindset going into it.
Yeah, and they've been around forever. Like, it's just wild how long Betty and Veronica have been around and how we're still seeing new spins on them, like, all of the time. Granted, there wasn't a huge, like, chasm of difference between them and, you know, their early appearances all the way up to, like, the 90s or something, but there were differences of some kind, and they just continue to go. Like, I think something like Riverdale was really interesting because it kind of reintroduced the concept of them, I guess, beyond like, you know, oh, in the 80s, you know, they have this cartoon or something. It kind of it had this kind of capacity to bring them into the present in a way, even though Riverdale, of course, is full of references to things from like 20, 30, 50 years ago, right? But it is modern in its own way. And I just think that there's just something really fascinating about kind of that staying power that they have. And do you have anything to say about that?
Well, that's something we really, really think about a lot with all of the characters. They have such strongly defined personalities and archetypes that you can drop them into literally any scenario and somehow it works. That's how we've been able to do what we do with horror, how we've been able to like go into all these different genres, try all these different things using these characters, because you can always recognize them. They are always very much themselves, no matter how bizarre the scenario is, but you see how the things that you identify with them work. Like, you know, how I could write a young adult, kid-friendly OGN about them, because that was the bond of friendship. And the whole thing about that was just Benny and Veronica have career day at school, and it makes them think about their different possible futures and careers and their friendship together. But then we could also have, to jump ahead a little bit, a series like Betty the Final Girl, where Betty is the final girl in a horror scenario. And you're not going to bat an eye about it, because it's like, well, yeah, I could see the resourcefulness she would have based on, you know, all the time she had to fix Archie's car. I could see how, like, they're just so versatile as characters, Betty and Veronica especially, but really all of the Archie characters. And it's how they've lasted for over 80 years and how we've been able to put them into increasingly new and weirder scenarios. And it just works.
I love Riverdale. Whenever I first started watching it, I was like the person that doesn't get it, right? I was like, this doesn't make sense on paper or something. And it was just like, oh, that's what they're doing, though. Like, they're taking all of these fun, different stories from fiction and just like throwing as many as they can into every episode in this way that I think, you know, over time, it grew on me so hard. Like, at first, I was like, I'm too cool. This is a show for teenagers. I am a grown-up. And then it turns out that I'm just, like, the exact demographic for Riverdale. As, like, a 40-year-old lesbian, it's for me, you know? And I was just like, you know, it's funny because I think that it does kind of a Trojan horse where it's like a lot of times if I hear somebody be critical of Riverdale, it will be something like, oh, but that's too bonkers or something. And I'm like, no, you have to understand that that's why it's so good. And I think that what you're saying about the characters and how iconic they are really lends itself in that series to be able to be like, look at all of these places where we can drop these characters. Here's Archie in an underground prison fighting ring, you know, and like, here's like Reggie running a casino with Veronica. You know, like there's just all of these. How does Veronica own a casino? She just does. And I believe it, you know, in my heart. And so I love these characters for exactly what you were just saying. Like they all have these very specific kind of iconic personalities that, you know, I think culturally we're just never going to get over because they're so real, kind of in a strange way. Like you feel almost like as long as I've been reading these characters, I feel like I know them, right? But that doesn't mean that they can't still surprise me. And so I think that that's what's wonderful about Riverdale, but that's also what's really wonderful about everything that the Comics line has been doing for years now, almost I think like a decade. If you know, it's been quite a while since the beginning of the horror line itself, but even before that, like, you know, I feel like there's just been a lot of intentionality around kind of expanding into different plots and different possibilities, but also you always have these core characteristics that really weigh the story. And I guess I'd just like to hear. I'm like, that's not a question, but I'd love to talk more about it.
No, you hit the nail right on the head. That's 100% it. It's, you know, because of the strength of the core characters and their personalities, as long as you have those elements intact, you can really build any story you want around them because you'll recognize them and you can see how these certain personality traits they have will allow them to adapt to these different changes. And once you have that, you can pretty much go wild. Sometimes I'm even amazed by how many more ideas that like we can come up with and we can do based on these characters.
Yeah, I'm honestly really obsessed with it. I think that it reminds me a lot whenever I was a kid, because as I said, like Archie Digest at the grocery store, it is my exact jam. I would like always be grabbing those off the shelf and being like, we gotta read this. Like, Mom, Dad, I don't want candy. I want Archie Digest. Mm-hmm. But it's just kind of an interesting thing to me because it's like even back then, like all the you look through and they were already doing stuff like this, right? Like I remember Archie superhero stuff, you know, like I remember all of these different kind of realms that the series was kind of going in. And it would be like, oh, here's like one, it's a one-off. We're only doing this for like, it's like a fake story or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's been something that's been present in the franchise for a really long time. So I think that it's interesting that now it's turned more into like, that's what the franchise is, baby. Like we're going to kind of push the boundaries as much as we can while keeping these like core values intact. And I think that, you know, it's helped me kind of just like grow with the characters in a way that I wouldn't necessarily have thought that I was going to as a kid. So I just think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, and that's so true. You know, everything we say now is a lot. We always want a surprise. We always want people to just keep seeing what we do because they never know what we're going to do next. But none of this is out of character for us. Just like you said, we've always tried new things. We've always, for as long as Archie's been around, that's been something that we've done. There were times in the 90s where we would have all these like really short miniseries or like one-offs. Just like, it felt like anything you could throw at the wall and see what would stick. Like we did
Archie
that all
meets
the time.
Punisher, right? Like yeah, that's yeah. It's one of the most kind of weirdly iconic, you know, comics from the 90s, I think, because it's one of those things where people will be like, LOL, Archie meets Punisher. That's hilarious. And it's like, yeah, I think that the creative team was aware of how hilarious that is, you know, in a way that like it still is a good story by the end of it, because you're just like, I never would have thought how Archie and Punisher would have a conversation. And now I know, right?
Exactly. And, you know, for going back to the earliest incarnations of the company back in the 40s, you know, we were doing obviously more superhero stuff. We were doing what was more popular at the time. And we ended up striking gold with Archie because what nobody else was really doing at that time was a comic about a teenager, just your everyday kid. But even past that, we would dip our toes into horror. We, you know, our earliest horror series date all the way back to like the 60s and 70s. This is something we've tried before. We do it and then we stop. We just, you know, we've always been willing to bend with the times. We've always been willing to try something new. Whenever we get to a place where we feel like we haven't evolved or we haven't done something new or different or interesting, we make an intention to do that and move forward with it. And that's something especially John Goldwater, who is our CEO and publisher, that's always his thing. He always wants to be innovating and always wants to be taking these characters to new and different places. And it just makes it a lot of fun to work on.
Oh, yeah. No, it seems like it's one of the most fun. I always am happy to see what you all are putting out because I'm just like, I get a lot of it through PR stuff. I get like PR emails and stuff. And I'll like be, what am I going to open this email to? And I truly never actually know, because whenever I got a horror anthology, I was like, what? Like, this is, it's so my exact jam. Once again, it's like one of those weird things where it's like, did my phone hear me say that I wanted this? And now it's, you know, being thrown back at me. It's just exactly what I love. And I'm kind of dancing around the horror line a lot right now because I have a lot to say about it. So I want to get some other things out first, but that is definitely like something that's really compelled me too, is just seeing, you know, I mean, Sabrina, what a perfect character, and having her kind of reintroduced to the world as this like horror character, because for a long time we know her as like, you know, the Melissa Joan Hart show. No shade to that show, because that was like everything to me as a kid, right? Like, it's great, like I love it. But then it's like over time, you know, Sabrina kind of changes, and that's very much the same with like a lot of these kind of iconic characters from the Archie line. But I was thinking, too, that one of my favorite Betty and Veronica stories that I've read in maybe like the last 20 years is Betty and Veronica meet Red Sonja and Vampirella, which is like so bonkers. It's exactly Archie meets Punisher level, where you're just like, what? How's that? And then you open it up and it's just like, this is the most fun comic I've literally ever read, because, you know, Amy Chu just like nails it on every point, because it's like you can tell like a lot of the people who I see writing and doing, you know, art for creating these comics, it's like everybody seems very much in on the joke. And also it's not a joke, right? Like it's like both, where it's like, we're here having fun with this, but also this is like where these characters should be going. And I think that that's just truly admirable. Like, it's something that I really love about the franchise.
Yeah, definitely. And Amy Chu is fantastic. She's amazing. And that is...
Yeah, we've had her on the show 2 times, and both times we're just like, you're so smart. Like, say more things. Like, and, you know, you really only have to prod her like 1 time, and yeah, it's just like, off. Here's your brilliant interview.
Yeah, that is totally it. And like, it's funny because sometimes, you know, when I'm working with writers, when we're having the back and forth leading into the script or even in the script notes, you get those elements of like, this is fun. Make this as absurd as possible. Like the notes to the artist, like go over the top. But then the script and the lines itself are like really in the moment and in seriousness. Yeah. And it's kind of cool to like, it's 100% that. It's we will be the first ones to make the joke. We're not only in on the joke, we are setting you up. You know, we are giving you the setup joke. But we take it seriously when it comes to the execution, because we're not taking ourselves too seriously with a lot of these, but we're serious about making something that's really good quality.
Yeah, the quality speaks for itself, I was going to say, because this is always stuff that I really, truly look forward to getting anything that I end up picking up. It's like you all have so much stuff that I know I miss things, but every single time I read an Archie comic, I'm like, hell yeah, that was great. And it's exactly what I kind of think I would have gotten to. You know, it's like... it's just wild because it's like, you know, I'm 40 now. I probably read my first Archie comic when I was like five. So it's just like the staying power of this franchise in my life has just been like kind of incredible. And as I said, maybe not something I would have predicted, but it's so nice to see so many people who just equally love the franchise, right? And they're the ones who are writing it. And that's excellent.
That's, yeah, I've been super fortunate that I've had so many amazing writers and artists who just love the characters and love the franchise, and especially love being able to do a story that lets them put this weird spin, like, I got to be the person that made Archie do this. Like, I got to be the person that put them in this bizarre scenario. So and it's so cool because you could see that love come through in like every step of the way. One thing we also at Archie always say is the Archie fan base ranges from ages 8 to 80. And we intend on being with you from every point during that lifespan. Like, you may step away from a while. You may go through a phase where you think you're too cool for it. But then we're going to put out something that makes you realize, like, oh, never mind. They're also doing something very cool. So we're going to be there for every part of that.
You know what? I think I'm going to hold you to that. Like, I'm very excited to be 80 and still reading Archie. But, you know, it really doesn't seem like it's out of the realm of possibility. So I'm glad and I'm looking forward to it. Happy holidays, everybody. Just kidding. It's not even a holiday. This is just the late month of January, which is basically what I would consider to be an opposite of a holiday. All of the holidays are done right now and we will get no more anytime soon. So what's your favorite holiday? Which one would you rate 5 stars and which one would you rate 0 stars?
Halloween, of course.
Oh, a 5-star holiday. Yeah, that's not a bad one. Now, which one would you rate 0 stars?
Christmas.
That's a deep cut because we talked about this in a prior episode, a Patreon episode about Star Trek, where we discovered that you really don't like Christmas, but also that none of us really like Christmas all that much. So I'm going to say 0 stars for me as well. Maybe 1 star because I like the hats, but that's all I got. You got a good hat on your holiday, and I'm going to probably have to give it at least 1 star. So there's other things that you can rate, review. For instance, you could rate and review this podcast. We don't pretend to like Christmas, and we never will, but you could rate and review us if you would like. And if you were to rate and review us, you could say something like, your rabbits are beautiful, and I hope you have a happy life, and this podcast is my favorite podcast I've ever listened to. And I'll be like, that's great.
5 stars.
5-star review. And this is also like, you know, not maybe an 80-year legacy, but certainly a long legacy as being this kind of, I would say, one of the zines that made good, right? Like kind of a zine that kind of like took off to be this a bigger publication and ended up being this one of the very few things. You know, I was a kid in like a rural town and, you know, I could find Razor Cake and I could find like Maximum Rock and Roll sometimes. And that would be like it, right? So whenever you're getting into punk, I think that Razor Cake has played such a huge role in that for so many people. So we'll talk about that in a second. But what I was kind of wondering what you think, because, you know, I would say that Vixens is a pretty punk series and you have, you know, Archie, you know, has, you know, it's, I remember reading a story from the 60s where Archie and Reggie and Jughead start a band, and it's not the Archies. They're not like good. They're bad. Right. Like that's the joke is that they're terrible. And they're like, Those old people are always trying to tell us what to do, but we're too hip for them. And like totally just so funny and like rebellious kind of. All of the adults are like holding their ears and like the music notes are all like bent and wild, you know, and like Archie's just yelling his head off. So I'm like, you know what? Like Archie's pretty punk kind of. So I'm wondering if you think that there is, if there's like a strong connection between Archie and punk and like kind of that can obviously punk means so many things. But, you know, so that could mean fashion wise, that could mean politically, like that could mean, you know, personality wise, like do you think that there is crossover, I guess, in the writing that you do for this and the writing that you do for that?
Definitely in terms of the writing, for sure. I would also say, too, one of the things about Razor Cake that's amazing, on top of everything else, is it's still DIY. It's still nonprofit. It's still, you know, it never abandoned its roots. And it's still prevalent to this day, which is so cool. And Archie is really interesting because Archie is still an independently family-run small business. Like, it is still... have been just like defying all the rules by being this smaller operation, still family owned and operated, still just everything we've kind of got, we fought hard for. And I think that, like, it's that, you know, a lot of times people might think of us as the underdog, but we're very scrappy about it. And we always like fight, and we are still here, and we're still doing things and surprising people. And that's just such a punk rock, like, overall vibe. So just in general, I feel like that's definitely an element of it. And for sure in my writing, and that came out the most in Vixens. Vixens was the first Archie comic I ever wrote. I had done some writing for the company before in other capacities, but that was the first comic ever. And it was like, we have to do something that'll turn heads. And, you know, I came up with this idea of a girl gang. And it was definitely a very punk rock, like, this is not what you're going to expect. This is the girls... taking charge. This is them fighting, you know, against aggressors. This is all of this. I 100% brought that to the table, especially with Vixens. And I think that's just the attitude going with everything too, where it's just like, fight hard, do this unexpected thing, never forget, you know, what your values are. And that to me is just ultimately punk.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating to me because I was like, am I going to be able to make a connective thread between Archie and punk? And it's like, yeah, of course. I mean, it really is kind of built into the concept in a way. And yeah, like you say, the more you're kind of pressing boundaries, I guess, like, and getting these ideas, like, you know, I don't think anybody would blame the Archie line if it was still the same thing it was 100 years ago or whatever. Well, 80 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that people would, that's probably what people would expect generally, is like, this happened then and now we're still doing that because it's so successful. But then I think that there's something, you know, really to be said about being like, actually, let's try it this way. And that is very much a punk thing. It's like all of the punk bands that are like, that do like one disco album or something, where you're just like, oh, and those are always my favorite albums. So maybe I'm finding out something about myself, which is that, you know, I really like it when the Sex Pistols become Public Image Limited. So I clearly like it whenever Archie becomes Afterlife with Archie. So, but yeah, do you think that there's like kind of a connective thread there?
Yeah, I could totally see that. I think that it just goes to the whole, like, not being afraid to try, not being afraid to step outside of your comfort zone. Again, not compromising who you are, but being willing to try something different just to see what happens and just to see what kind of change it could bring. I totally see that. Also, to be more on the nose, we also had Archie Meets the Ramones. So we've definitely gone way more.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we have Archie Meets the Ramones.
You're like, it's subtextual, and then it's also in your face, actually,
like,
Archie
exactly.
is very punk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking too, because you first started with Razor Cake doing show reviews, right?
Yes.
And then now you're mostly doing the bi-monthly column. Is that correct?
Correct.
I would love to hear a little bit about that and how that kind of transition worked for you, because it seems like those are, I'm not going to say totally different realms, but it does seem like there's been kind of a trajectory, right? So I'd love to hear, I guess, first of all, what got you interested in doing show reviews, and then how has that kind of changed over time into this column?
That's a good question. So it's funny, when I started doing the show reviews, because that was literally one of those, like, I just, you know, shot my shot. I was like, I always have, I guess, that part, that writerly part of my brain, where whenever I'm enjoying something that's not writing, it's like, how could I bring writing into this? Like, how can I take this thing I love and merge it with this other thing I love to do, but I don't exercise enough? And it was just one particular week it was like the week of Halloween, I had gone to a string of shows and had like a varying experiences with it. I always liked Razor Cake. I knew they had done live show reviews, and I was like, I had such an interesting week of going to a bunch of different shows what if I pitched doing live reviews? And what if my thing, because it's like, yeah, anybody can review a show. Anybody could say like, oh, this sounded great. Oh, they played this. But I'm like, I don't want to talk about how the band performed. I want to talk about my kind of reaction to it and what it, you know, what I felt during it. And my reviews became way more about like whatever was going on with me as like through the lens of this show. And I'm like, this is weird. This is a strange way to approach this, but I'm going to go for it. I'm going to send an email, see if they're interested, give them a kind of glimpse of what I could do, do it for them. And my editor, Todd, loved it and was just like, whenever you go to shows, if you want to do more, please do. And then I think there was just a point in time where I had slowed down going to shows in general. So it was really just kind of gnawing at me because it's like, I want to keep writing, but I don't have the money to keep buying tickets to go to these concerts. And like, I had just slowed down and, you know, Todd had liked what I had done so much that he was having me do like rewriting intros for past interviews, just kind of keeping me on board. And then one day he messaged and he was like, listen, you know, I really enjoy your writing. Is there anything else? Would you like, if you were to do a column, what would you want to talk about? And I was like, oh wow, this is kind of amazing. And I had dabbled here and there with like some other publications, some that like never really got off the ground, but you know, like smaller startups where I did talk more frankly about mental health. And my thing was like, how can I merge talking about, you know, my anxieties, my mental health, and punk? I'm like, I feel like it's not that far of a thread. And I feel like just being open and talking about it and being frank about it in and of itself is pretty punk rock. So I pitched it and he was like, yeah, yeah, please do that. And I've been doing it for the past, I forget how many years at this point. And I think the most amazing thing is I always think I'm going to run out of topics to talk about. I never do. When it comes to anxiety, there's always a lot to talk about.
Yeah, it turns out, right? You're just like, well, look at that, mental illness here again.
And yeah.
I still have things to say because I continue to be interacting with it.
Exactly, exactly.
And, you know, there really is. I mean, I think that that's something, too, because there's, you know, not more than other music genres, but there, as there is so many people in music over time who have struggled with any number of mental illness issues, often enough, like that's something, you know, in all of our lives where people are like, don't talk about it. Right. And, you know, I think that if you look back, you know, in our personal histories, in music history and art history, there's all of these kind of tragic stories that are just like, maybe talking about it really could have helped, right? Yeah. So I think that it is important to talk this stuff out. So I'm just thrilled that, you know, you've had this platform to do it through Razorcake for such a long time, because I think that actually, it might have been the first thing from you that I read, because I think I remember picking up an issue of Razorcake. I don't get it every single time it comes out, but I still pick up the issues when I see them on the stands, which is, it's like, there's certain like habits as a consumer that you'll just never get over. And it's like, if I see a punk magazine on the stand, I'm going to buy it. Right.
Same here.
And yeah. So I just think that there is something very interesting, I guess, about how, you know, kind of being frank and discussing it. It's like, there's so many things in your writing and kind of your career trajectory that it just all seems to interplay so well, right? So I've been thinking about that, like before while I was getting ready for the interview, I was like, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, we're dealing with horror. Horror is a place where, you know, classically mental illness is not, it's like, often dealt with in metaphor, but it's one of the few places where we see it dealt with, right? Yes. Like it's something where like 100 years ago, we're seeing characters that are struggling with mental health issues. And, you know, it is such a like metaphor, right? So do you think, oh man, it's like, I'm so close to having an actual question, but it's almost like, that's just kind of an observance, I guess. Like punk has this kind of like, you know, so many of the songs that I love, like I Can't Escape Myself by The Sound or like something like that, right? You have these songs that are very directly engaging in dealing with mental health issues. And then you have, you know, something like Frankenstein, which is dealing with kind of like societal issues that reflect on our mental health. And then you know, horror, punk, all of these things. Do you feel like there is kind of a connective thread in these mediums? And is there something that uniquely draws you to these mediums because of this?
I think that societal element is huge, because I think you get strong reflections of society and, you know, both the ills and the cures in some ways in right. both punk and horror, whether it be metaphorically or a little bit more direct and in your face. But there's that call to action sort of element of it that you can get from both. And sometimes with horror, it's literally just, you know, holding this weird distorted mirror to a situation that's happening. But it stops and it makes you think about it while still getting you riled up in some way, right? Like whether it's fear or just adrenaline. I think it's that adrenaline factor too. You know, there's nothing like the rush of like a live punk show. And sometimes you get an almost similar feeling when you're watching like a thriller or something where you're just, you know, kind of amped up waiting to see what happens next.
Yeah, that's super interesting to me. I'm gonna have to think about this even more, like after the call. But yeah, on the way in, I was like, I like themes that are relevant to one another. Like whenever I'm trying to like come up with questions, it's always just kind of funny because I like my way of approaching life, I guess, is just to constantly be having an existential crisis about everything, right? And so you have this kind of like, but what does it mean to the larger theme of things? And so all of my questions very much are just kind of like five things. What do you think about them all together in a room or something, you know?
And I love finding sometimes those threads that I never thought about before. But when I like view them all together in that way, being like, oh, wow, there is a connective tissue.
Yeah, we talked about there's like the story that Herman Melville didn't realize that Moby Dick was allegorical, right? And that always makes me laugh because you're just like, oh, of course it's allegorical. But then it's like the second somebody reads one of my short stories, like I write horror short stories. If somebody reads one of my short stories and they're just like, oh, this is like dealing with like gentrification, I'm just like, is it? Like what? So it's like we're all Herman Melville, right? Like we all kind of are just like, I didn't know that the white whale was allegorical. I just thought I was talking about a huge whale that's like white, you know? Yeah, I was thinking too, because you not only have written so much for Razor Cake, but you've also done satire writing, right? So from what I remember, you've written for The Hard Times. Is that correct?
I did brief stoke The Hard Times, yeah.
So I was curious too, because there is, it's once again, kind of these like similar themes where it's like, you know, I get from the column that it's like you have like a very sincere love of punk, right? But then there's also this idea that you can kind of tease around it and kind of make fun of it with something like The Hard Times, which like, you know, the headlines always crack me up. But it's just kind of something interesting. But I was like, that's almost the same as Archie too, because like, you know, it's something that we like love, but also here's the humor to it. And then also here's what's serious about it. So I was kind of wondering how you feel that satire kind of played a role in your writing process and kind of how your writing has developed, I guess.
Well, I always wanted to write comedy. I think if I were to like zoom out and look at like what I wanted to be as a kid, for a long time, it was a writer for Saturday Night Live. There were points where I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. It's hard. I haven't done it as much because I think writing comedy is one of the toughest things in the world. And I give kudos to anybody who can do it, because I always say like tragedy is pretty straightforward. There are universal truths and there are some things that are always going to be really sad, but not everybody finds the same thing funny. And finding your humor, like your humorous voice, is really tough. And I'm so fascinated by like processes when it comes to writing jokes and writing skits. And like, that's one of my big things that I'll like nerd out over. If there's anything when people walk through, like, this is how I wrote this joke and why it was funny. Like, I find that so interesting. And I think that's one thing that like, I still struggle with a little bit because it's just so tough. So getting to do a little bit of satire was fun. And it was easy to dip my toes into it with something like punk because it's something I'm a little more intimately connected with. I can make these more on the nose jokes that I understand from this kind of niche thing. But I also think that helped a little bit too, even with my comic writing, because, you know, Vixens was obviously this female empowerment, very action heavy script, but I always, if I can, love to have elements of humor in it. And I'm very much dialogue driven. So like, I think the funniest things usually come from back and forth dialogue. So I tried to bring in as many elements of that as I could. And that's something, even when I'm writing currently, like because I'm doing more of the editorial stuff, I've stepped away a little bit from writing on the comic side, but I do still occasionally write for the digest line. And what's really interesting with the digest stories is you have 5 pages. It's a 5-page story. And if you ever need just like an ultimate masterclass or lesson in storytelling and comedy writing, give yourself 5 pages, no more, and make sure you can tell a story and get a joke in that frame, or multiple jokes in. And I think, like, of all the writing, like, the satire stuff was fun to play with, but I feel like writing for digest has really, like, helped me, like, you know, if it doesn't fit, you gotta trim it. And does this joke still work if you have to take out these elements? Is this joke still funny? If not, how can you make it funny in this limited space? Has been, I think, the biggest lessons I've learned when it comes to writing, especially comedy writing.
Oh, and the old Archie comics are just an absolute masterclass, mentioned. Yeah. It's just like, those jokes hold up forever. Like, I was reading a digest collection a little while ago, and, you know, I mentioned Punk Archie, which was hilarious. Like, that's such a funny story, but it's like maybe 5-6 pages tops. And then you have, there's one where, like, the first 2 pages is Betty, Reggie, Veronica, Archie all in a room, and the whole conversation is one of them being like, I'm going to do it. And the other one's like, oh, no, you're not. And then the other one's like, well, then I'll do it. And the other one's like, oh, no, you won't. Like, it just goes on for like 2 pages. And then you never actually find out like what they're arguing about until like the very end of the story. Yeah. And it's just like, that's just goddamn brilliant. Like, I mean, it's like we don't give enough credit for that, I don't think, because, you know, Archie of the olden days were kind of like, oh, yeah, that's like, you know, antiquated gender politics and like all of this stuff. And it's like, yeah, totally, you know, in a lot of ways, that's true. But it's also more progressive than I would think sometimes, first of all. And then also, it's just funny. Like, these are jokes that will just, you know, they'll probably still be funny 50 years from now.
And it's funny because I said that I'm very much somebody who's like dialogue motivated, but some of the best and funniest stories are like the classic Bob Montana, Harry Lucy ones, where there's not a line of dialogue at all, where it's just visual for like 5 pages. And some of those, just the physical comedy element is amazing. Those are always like just excellence.
So I wanted to say too, because, you know, I remember reading those like digests and whatnot, and you have those the fashion pages, right? And there's something really cool about that, because I think that these are characters that are also kind of underrated fashion icons. And they have these throughout the ages, you know, like anytime they pop up, they'll have these like fashion spreads that are just pictures of, you know, Betty and Veronica trying on any number of outfits of the time. So I was curious if you have an interest in those pages as well. And then also, does that play into the writing that you're doing? Like, you know, not even talking about the editorial side of things. Whenever you're writing an Archie story, do you think a lot about what the fashion is going to be like?
I definitely enjoyed those pages a lot as a kid. I like wanted to be a fashion designer very briefly when I was younger, before I realized I had very little art skills that would get me there. And I think some of my earliest introductions to that were those fashion pages, like Paper Dolls, those fashion pages. Those always stuck with me. When I was writing Vixens, that one, I definitely had like super specific outfits in mind for like, because it really helped to set the tone. Most of the time, unless it's very specific to the story, I don't think about it as much. I usually just trust that the artist will come up with something cool. But Vixens was one where like fashion was big for me in just how we designed it. Just again, because it's of such a weird, like, no real set time, I wanted to make sure that the fashion kind of went with that as well.
Right. Yeah, definitely. That's interesting. Yeah, Vixen, they all look great. So whoever hasn't picked up Vixen, like, go pick it up. You'll know what we're talking about immediately, right? Okay, well, guess what? We made it to the part of the interview where I'm just going to start throwing Archie horror questions at you.
So. Let's do it.
I'm like... very excited about this. I love this. It's been such a wonderful conversation so far. So thank you so much for talking to me about a lot of your work. And I would love to just, you know, get into this because, you know, as I said, Archie horror, these are two of my great loves in life. So I just love to see it together. I'm such a fan of this line. But, you know, and I know, like, as you were saying, your position has changed in the line. But what is it that makes you so compelled to continue working on the Archie horror, like that specific segment of the Archie world?
I mean, part of it is it's really what the fans respond to the best. And we definitely love to, you know, see what fans seem to take to the most. And horror just always gets people interested. But I think it's also because... you know, one of the things that I always emphasize, especially with doing so many different one-shots, is there are so many subgenres within horror that, like, you can target all of them. When we're doing an anthology, you could have, like, three different ones under one umbrella, or you can, like, you know, expand it for each, you know, individual one-shot. And it just gives us so much to work with that, like, you know, there's... because you could also, you know, take it to these wild places and you have to suspend so much disbelief. It just, like, it feels like an endless wellstream to pull from.
And it's like punk in that way too, right? Horror is, because you're just like, oh, there's so many subgenres that you go... whenever, to me, it's like when somebody says, I don't like punk music, I'm like, wow, I wonder what you mean by that, because there's so much punk in this world. Like, do you hate Blondie? Because I think everybody loves Blondie, right? But you're just like, and it's like, yeah, there's questions. Are they super punk? Are they true punk or something? And it's like, honestly, punk really is just that kind of, not, I wouldn't boil it down to an aesthetic, but I would boil it down to like kind of an attitude, I guess, in a lot of ways. And also just like, you know, it's a umbrella term in a way where you can kind of, you can fit, hey, Talking Heads, you get under this umbrella too. Like, yeah. Hey, the Ramones, like these are bands that aren't similar to one another, really. Like they have things kind of tying them together. And obviously punk has gone on, it's changed. There's so many punk bands, like there's no way any kind of, like my basic generalization here is actually including, you know, any number of punk bands. But it's kind of the same with horror, where somebody will be like, oh, you wrote a horror book. I'm not going to read it because I don't like horror. And I'm like, okay, you don't have to read my book, but why don't you like horror? Or like, what horror don't you like, I guess, is the most specific question I need to ask here. Because like, isn't Return to Oz kind of a horror movie? Like, you know, there's horror in everything, right? It's like what the genre that can seep into pretty much any other genre, and people will just watch it and not even realize that they're watching a straight up horror movie. And it's kind of subversive in that way, right?
Yeah, because I think a lot of people might reduce it to, you know, like, oh, I don't like jump scares. And it's like, well, that's not all right. That horror is, you know, there's so many different
like
takes
not even close.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's 100% it.
Really recently, you started doing anthologies, and horror anthologies have such a strong place in comics. And you have, you know, the Tales from the Crypt, you know, all of the old EC comics were very much told three stories to an issue anthology format. And that has inspired so many things. Like that inspired, you know, the movie Creepshow and horror series that we see on TV that do anthology style stuff, Black Mirror, you know, Twilight Zone. These are all really wonderful anthology series. So I was going to say, what do you think works so well about anthologies for horror specifically? Because, you know, I love an anthology no matter what the genre pretty much, because I just love a sample platter, I guess. but I'm curious what you think specifically works about anthologies for horror for Archie.
Well, you know what? It's very much in line with what we used to do when we first did horror and when we dabbled with it back in like the 60s and 70s. It was always in that anthology format. It was very much that like EC style, you know, creepy tales. It was of that time. So it was natural to us to do that. Obviously, we could expand upon it. You know, we did so much with Afterlife and Sabrina. But what I like about the anthology format is it kind of goes back to that digest mindset where it's like you have a smaller amount of space to work within. You have to tell the best possible story you can. So it's like you have to get that scare in there. You have to get that message. You have to get that story out. And you don't really have the time to expand or elaborate on things that might take away from that horror element because that's you just don't have room for it. So you have to go in, make sure you get whatever your scare is, you know, in there, make it have an impact in short amount of time, get in, get out. And then whoever's reading it will be satisfied with that, but then we'll also want more, which just means that, you know, they're going to come back for more when you do it again.
Yeah, I had this thing that I was working on pretty recently where I was like, okay, I'm going to do this as a horror short story. And then I was like, okay, that means that you have to clock in at like 5,000 words. Don't go over 5,000. That's like your big goal, right? And then I was like, okay, cool. Well, I made it right to 5,000 words and here's the story. And now I'm like, so what I actually have to do with this specific story is to make it a workable short, I need to take a bunch of things out, actually, because they need to go. They don't serve a huge purpose in this short. But if I want to do it as like a novel now, I need to add a bunch. So you have this kind of interesting thing where like shorts are always something that it's been my primary fiction. Like most of the fiction I've written has been short. And every single time it's like I still continue to learn and grow from it because it's like, you know, that's a very specific example, the story I was just talking about, because it's like I never made it to that place before where I was like, oh, I need to actually subtract. Like I hit my limit and was just like, okay, no more. But then it's like, oh, there should be less actually, because in order for it to like work as smoothly as I want it to, I need to take out some of these details that will actually serve a great purpose in a novel or something, right? So I just think that it is fascinating. And do you think that that's something, you know, whenever you're looking at anthology stories, like is it kind of an ongoing process for you as well? Like, is it like, oh, I actually think that this needs to be clipped slightly in order to work?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Especially from the editorial. And there's sometimes where it's like, hey, this is a cool element, but it's not, you know, it's dragging this a little bit. Or sometimes a writer might struggle with fitting the page count given. And I have to go through and just be like, I see the setup here. I see what you're going for. But what you're doing in like 3 pages, you could do in 1, because as much as all of that seems important for 3 pages, it's kind of dragging down that momentum a little bit, which just like, that's the big thing where it comes to sort of just like seeing where it could fit. Most people though are pretty good. I think everybody feels daunted sometimes by having a shorter space to tell a story within until they start doing it and realize like, oh, I had to trim a lot, but then it made those moments way more impactful, or I have to like get in, like maybe I don't have enough space to do this like slow burn, but if I have to do it quicker, then I just have to do something even creepier or even more horrifying with the space I have.
And that said, I want to say too that what you were talking about, comedy happens in dialogue. Sometimes horror happens in dialogue too. So it's one of those things where it's just like, as much as I'm 100% like, I sometimes when writing shorts will get in my own way. Like I like to say this all from my perspective, so I'm not incriminating. Like I'm not just like, we all do that. No, maybe just I do it. But I always will, you know, there's these moments where you're like, oh, that's like way too clumsy because you didn't have enough space to elaborate your point. Yes. So it's better just to let go of it. However, if you just replace that with like a page of dialogue that doesn't seem to go anywhere, but totally sets up the third page, then that's awesome.
Yeah. And sometimes so that's all like, it takes.
Yeah, totally. And that's kind of it, because I think like 9 times out of 10, you would have, when you're looking at something like horror, people are like, but that's not directly scary, so cut it. And it's like, there's so much of like the Babadook that isn't directly scary, but it's so much setup, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I think about that too. And I think that that's really the fine line, especially with horror, you know, with comedy as well, I think. But where it's just kind of like, you really, the way to nail it is to like, really have to like walk this very tight line, right? So I think that's interesting.
I've also been somebody who's always been drawn towards both reading and writing short stories. So it's that same element of like having to learn. And it's tough with writing because you realize sometimes you have to write a novel to get yourself down to a short story. Because sometimes you have to like, write this character's long backstory and all of this. And then once you've written it, realize what of that do you actually need that you're going to you? How much of that did you write for you and how much of it is going to be in the story?
Yeah, I think so. I was thinking too, the Archie line as the anthology that I've read pretty recently was reminded me a lot of like the Treehouse of Horrors a little bit, where it was like, oh, this kind of, you know, I think that even today, like the Treehouse of Horrors is probably the most popular thing that The Simpsons have ever done. And it has this kind of like, we're not totally in reality. Anybody could die, you know, like, but also it has a lot of fun drawing in outside references. Yes. So I was curious if there's any kind of like touchstone for that with you. Like, did you, I don't know anybody who hasn't seen Treehouse of Horror stuff, I don't think, but is that something, you know, was that something that you took any inspiration from, or is it just something where you just see like the line between them?
We definitely, when we did Fear the Funhouse last year, that was like a direct reference we made when we were coming up with the ideas with it. So that was definitely an intentional aspect. We typically, when we're coming up with ideas for things, we usually have some sort of pre-existing media property that we kind of like go to as the like, this is kind of what we're aiming for here. If it was Archie doing this, but in its own Archie way. And Treehouse was definitely a very intentional reference that we were making.
Yeah, cool. I was like, I hope I'm not like stretching too far on this, but it did seem kind of like, oh, but also like, again, it's something where it's like, there's, it's crossover, but in like the fun sense, right? Like it's like, you know, when people do like Twilight Zone pastiche or something, and it's like, you know what? I will show up to that every time. Like I will, for the rest of my life, will be seeing spins on the Twilight Zone that do just really interesting new things. And I think it's very much, you know, Treehouse of Horrors is wonderful and popular because it is, it delights in that, right? Yes. So I think that that's like the highest compliment that I can pay is just to be like, oh, that reminds me a little bit of this other thing that I absolutely love, right?
And I would say that and Twilight Zone have been two of the biggest ones that we go back to a lot, especially for the anthologies when we're just coming up with ideas and doing the setup for them.
Yeah, they're just flawless victory, pretty much.
So yeah, like, exactly.
They're like, thanks for that format. We'll just use it forever.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, because, you know, Betty is a final girl. What is it about Betty that lends to that? Because, you know, it was one of those comics where I was like, the second I saw it, it was like, can't believe that didn't already exist, actually. Like, that's such a good idea. And in many ways, I think, like, you know, in Riverdale, Betty is kind of a final girl fairly regularly. Not to that extent, because they can't, you know, kill off her entire cast. But she's put in these kind of, like, weird positions. Unique to Betty, I'll say, because, like, you know, Veronica's dealing with a completely different world. But I think that there's something really interesting about that. So I just wanted to hear a little bit about, you know, the premise behind it, I guess, and sort of why is it Betty? You know, why does Betty specifically fit into that kind of, what would you call it? Like, Final Girl isn't like a story or something. It's just like a trope, I guess, yeah, in a way, but
not in a negative sense, but yeah, definitely a horror trope.
Right.
So that came up because the writer of like that main framework story, Mikol Ostow, she was writing our Riverdale comics for a while. She had done like pretty much any Riverdale related book that's like on the market. Mikol's name is on in some way. And she had emailed me with the idea of doing a Final Girl story. And it was, she had just finished reading the Final Girl support group by Grady Hendrix and emailed me was like, what if we do that? And it was while I was also reading it. And I'm like, well, this all seems to be working out. And as soon as she said it, I'm like, of course. And like, it's gotta be Betty. And I think, especially with her writing Riverdale comics, definitely having to put Betty in a lot of those situations, it just, for her, it was a natural fit. And from my end, I think, like, kind of going back to what I said before, there's always been this, like, resourcefulness with Betty, whether it's, like, scheming to get Archie away from Veronica or, like, having to sort of you know, she doesn't have the resources that Veronica has, so she has to do a lot of stuff herself. It makes sense that she would be the type of person who, when put in that situation, would maybe know how to navigate it a little better than everyone else.
Yeah, she probably would. I'm like, now that I think about it, like, what would Veronica's response be?
But Veronica would just call somebody else to handle it.
Because I was like, it's like literally like the killer is outside with a knife, Ghostface is here, and she's just like beep 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 beep. Need some help with the serial killer outside of my window.
Yeah.
If it has plenty of people on hand, probably doesn't need to worry about this ever. Whereas Betty actually could be alone in her house watching horror movies and then Ghostface shows up, right?
Right.
Because she does. She has that sort of, like, she has to be resourceful kind of thing. And that's been popping up in Betty's stories since the beginning. So, yeah, it's definitely one where I was like, I cannot believe I haven't already read this story in a way, but that's like, that just speaks to like the brilliance of it where you're just like, oh, I never would have thought of this. And I love it so much.
That's always something too. Like whenever I'm amazed by an idea somebody has, it's just like, wow, I can't believe we haven't actually done that before. Like that's just too perfect to pass up on.
Right. So, I mean, you know, I think I could probably just continue asking Archie horror questions for the rest of my life, probably. But just to wrap it up, we're basically at time. I don't want to keep you for the, you know, the rest of my life. I will now ask, is there something that is on the horizon for you? Because it's like we talked a lot about, you know, the various projects you've worked on and kind of the themes between them. Is there something that you would like to try that you haven't had a chance to try? You know, whatever the case that could be, this can be something that's either on the horizon and or you just would like to put it on the horizon at some point. And then, yeah, I guess like we'll talk a little bit about what you would like to plug.
Oh man, that's tough. Like I said, any time I could dip my toes more into comedy and learn more about it, I'm happy to. Anything like that from my own personal writing is something I'm always interested in getting back to and finding new ways to do. So that's more of like a wish fulfillment thing on my end.
Right.
And then as far as it goes with like Archie stuff, like really the sky's the limit. So if there's something we haven't done yet, it's probably something we can make happen as long as the story's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that warms my heart too, because I really am just excited, you know, like it's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, I'll probably be here every step of the way. So I love everything that you've been doing and I'm looking forward to everything that's on the horizon. I'm just excited. But that said, you know, what should people be picking up? And like, I know the fact that I don't actually know when this is going to air might throw slightly a wrench into this answering, but what can you plug right now that's going to be kind of like an evergreen thing?
Yeah, so our next comic coming out is on May 17th, and that is Jinx, A Cursed Life. So that's another horror one-shot based on our teen character, Lil Jinx, now more of a teen. We started telling her story a little bit in an anthology series last year. We picked up on it for Free Comic Book Day. This one goes into more of just her story. It's very... One of the big things that was a driving force behind it was my best friend's exorcism. So it's got a lot of that. She is the daughter of Satan. She is being tasked with having to exorcise a possessed Jughead. It's amazing. It's written by Magdalene Visaggio with art by Craig Cermak. And it is gorgeous and hilarious and horrifying. And I highly recommend it. The following month in June, we have Camp Pickens, which is a all camp-based horror tales. That one's a lot of fun. That's very much perfect for summer. We were thinking of like American Horror Story 1984, The Quarry Games, Sleepaway Camp. That one is three short stories, all based in camp. We created this Camp Pickens that is this sort of like haunted campground that everyone in Riverdale still goes to for some reason. And here's a couple of like the weird things that happen. We've got Tim Seeley and Mike Norton on that one, which is amazing because Revival was one of my favorite comics ever. So getting to work with those two guys was just fantastic. Those are our two upcoming that have already been announced horror comics. Also in September, we have the graphic novel collection of a bunch of our anthologies. That's the Chilling Adventures Presents. So it's a few of the ones that came out over the past few years, just to sort of, if you haven't jumped on yet to the anthologies and the one-shots, that's a great place to start.
Oh, that's so fun. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I love a haunted campground. Like, what's better than that?
It's another thing that, you know, it's perfect for us to do. We've definitely touched upon it in, like, older stories here and there, but this is our first, you know, modern era version of it.
Well, what about you? Where can people find you online? What do you have that people can follow? And I guess that's all of the questions. Where can people find you if you want to be found?
Yeah. So my website is jamieleerotante.net. I have a link to all of my Razor Cake articles on there, and those come out bi-monthly. You can find me on Twitter at Jamitha, Jamitha, and on Instagram at Jamie Lee Rotonde.
Excellent. Thank you so much for taking this time and talking to me about one of my favorite franchises and one of my favorite parts of one of my favorite franchises. This has been really fun.
Yeah, I've had a blast. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, no worries. I was like, I think that... Yeah, Jesse Post hooks us up with a lot of great interviews and sent an email where it was just like, here's some Archie stuff. What do you think? I'm like, I'm obsessed with it. So let's set this up. So I'm glad that it worked out. For listeners, you know what? Follow us on the Bitches on Comics site. Follow us on whatever social media platforms you're on. I think that we have accounts on most of them, If we don't, let us know. We'll start one just for you. We have a Patreon you can subscribe to. It's patreon.com/queerspec. So QUEERSPEC. I'm sure that there's something else I'm supposed to be adding, but at the end of podcast, I'm always completely brain fried where I've just like talked a bunch about things that I love. And so then I'm like, oh, I got to go eat a snack or something. And I completely forget the 700 things that I'm supposed to say at the end of an episode. However, if you start at the website, I'm sure you're going to find your way to a lot of magical things, I guess is what I'm going to say. And thanks so much for being here. As always, thanks so much for listening to the podcast and showing support to us. You're all truly wonderful people. And thanks again for being here, Jamie.
Thank you. This is a great time.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @bitchesoncomics and on Instagram at @bitchesoncomics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land, the Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.